On this episode of the Haunted Objects podcast.
Yeah, he came on the radio and I was like, and you were like, he made a restaurant called Mom's Spaghetti. And I was like, but he threw up Mom's Spaghetti.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know.
Bringing us back to tonight's focal point, diarrhea.
Diarrhea.
From deep inside the mysterious archives of the Newkirk Museum of the Paranormal, it's the Haunted Objects Podcast.
Sometimes I wonder if we're ever going to see any kind of paranormal event that is as culturally impactful as the Amityville Horror.
I don't think so. I think the only way that that could potentially ever happen would be if some kind of physical evidence was captured that was undeniably real. Because I think that that's the only thing that would set anything apart from all of the constant content that's being made about the scariest place on earth, which is like something new every 5 seconds.
Well, what do you mean? There's undeniable evidence every week on Travel Channel.
I mean something that like scientists could absolutely test and go, nope, this is real. Ghosts are real. Ghosts are, like, Bigfoot's real. Like, that's the only way that that could happen, I think.
I feel like there will never be another Amityville Horror.
Yeah.
Because we are so inundated with, as you said, the best evidence ever.
Yeah.
Every single week.
Yeah.
You see it on YouTube. You see it on TikTok. You see it on Travel Channel, Discovery Plus. You see it everywhere.
Yes.
History Channel.
It's almost a trope at this point.
And it's, we're so oversaturated when it comes to, there's like, we watched the Amityville Horror the other day and it is not nearly as scary or as extreme as the stuff that you see on a new episode of Ghost Adventures.
No, like nothing really happens.
No.
Nothing really, like somebody got their fingies squished at one point.
And George had diarrhea.
And George had a lot of diarrhea.
That's only in the book though. I don't know why they didn't make that part of the movie adaptation.
I really wish there had been like a solid plot point about George having explosive diarrhea for the entire month.
He just spends the first 15, the whole first act is just him on the pot.
Yeah, it's referenced so many times. so many times.
And then other people get diarrhea?
Yeah.
We don't even have to do this podcast. We've solved it. They had the food poisoning.
Yeah. Like, they mentioned the amount of diarrhea this man had so many times, it feels like a roast. Like, it feels like they're roasting George Lutz with the amount of time. And then the other line that makes me laugh is the line about how he bangs his wife every single night.
Every night?
Every single night since they've been married.
You would hate me.
Yeah. I mean, that's not real. It's not a real thing. It's just funny. It's like George was like, listen, you said I had diarrhea like 300 times, so at least let people think I'm like a fucking dude in the, like a good dude in the sack. You know what
but I mean? The problem is they talk about him having diarrhea and then going right to banging
her.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. It's he's being roasted by the author, I'm telling you.
Like, do you know how embarrassing it is to have sex when you have to fart? Imagine having diarrhea.
It's just that's not a game you want to play, like, at all. It's a bad idea.
Well, we're here today to talk about the diarrheal horror, the real title of the Amityville Horror.
Yes.
I don't think we'll ever see an Amityville Horror again.
No.
And I really do think the reason is, we are so, we're just flooded with Amityville Horrors every week.
Yes.
There's a new one constantly.
Yeah.
The mainstream media is constantly talking about paranormal stuff. We have UFOs in the sky and the news everywhere. Mm-hmm. People are just so desensitized to it. Mm-hmm. When the Amityville Horror came out, when that story dropped, it was massive. It was such a huge deal because we weren't flooded with it constantly.
Yes, yeah.
And again, when you go back, you read the book, you watch the movie, it's sensational.
Yeah.
But it doesn't hold a candle to some of the stuff that's just an episode of a TV show that we see anymore.
Yes. It's like a couple things happen. And like one of the things that are like super scary is a marching band. We heard a marching band. That's awesome. That's not scary. Why would you be? I mean, here's the thing. I'd be scared if I heard a marching band, but I wouldn't go, it was definitely demons. Like a marching band.
Oh, no. We're going to talk about this today.
Yeah, we're going to break it down.
There's so many details that are glossed over when you talk about the Amityville Horror. There's details about how they investigated the case, who investigated it. There's even some really interesting skeptical arguments that I've never even really thought about. But the reason we're talking about the Amityville Horror today is because we have an artifact that is from 112 Ocean Avenue, mm-hmm. arguably the most iconic haunted house in all of history. We're talking about the Amityville Plank.
Pried from the walls of the world's most infamous haunted house, this unassuming plank of wood bore witness to an event that would forever be known as the Amityville Horror. After moving into their dream home, George and Kathy Lutz claim that their children spoke with demonic pigs. The walls dripped with putrid slime, and priests were driven from the home by plagues of insects. Just 28 days later, the family fled after Kathy was discovered levitating in her bed, bound by an otherworldly force. Does the dark energy of 112 Ocean Avenue still linger inside the Amityville Plank? For those who've witnessed its mysterious vibrations, ghostly emanations, and the frightening paranormal phenomena manifested in its presence, there's no doubt that the Amityville Horror lives on. But just who or what is this possessed plank channeling?
The Amityville Horror story is one of the most iconic ghost stories in American history.
Yeah.
I don't know too many that seem as popular. Like, yeah. Even people who don't know anything about the Amityville Horror,
they know about that story.
Or they know the story.
They recognize the house because the house is so iconic. As you said, it's like got such a definitive look to it that it's impossible, like, almost for most people, whether you care about horror or not, to see the kind of the eyes, the glowing eyes, and people will know immediately what it is.
To give everybody a brief overview, in case you don't know the facts behind the Amityville case.
Yes.
Where this whole crazy story of blood dripping from walls,
black
demonic
toilets.
Pigs. Yeah, black toilets, sacrificial rooms.
Yeah.
Where all of this stuff started with a murder that occurred at 112 Ocean Avenue back in November of 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald DeFeo Jr. went through his home,
mm-hmm.
and he killed six members of his family, his
yes.
whole family. He
yeah.
killed six people in the middle of the night. None of them appeared to have put up a struggle. They were all in their beds.
Yeah.
Shot them with a rifle, a loud one.
Yes.
And which, no one moved.
Which is a weird detail.
Very strange detail. And then was apprehended fairly quickly after this.
Yeah.
And sent to prison. During his trial, he talked about how the devil made him do it.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there was a woman in a black hood with black hands that handed him a rifle,
mm-hmm.
and told him to kill his family. And then when it was done, he was shocked at what he'd done. Whether or not that's true, I mean, that's up for debate. Clearly trying for an insanity plea, didn't work, got sentenced, went to jail. Not too long after that, the Lutz family saw the house and got it for a screaming deal.
Yeah.
I think they paid $80,000 for it. Is that the case?
They did. And it was a little over a year from the night of the crime. So I think it was December of the next year. They bought the house for $80,000. The house, the boathouse, the whole... All the furniture. All the furniture, everything.
It was still in the house.
It was all just one big package.
Would you move into a house with all the original furniture if you'd known that half a dozen people were brutally murdered in that place, not even a year later or before that?
You know what? I would. And what would happen is this. I would be very confident beforehand, and I'd be psyched about it. I'd be like, that sounds weird. Maybe psyched is not the right word.
Psyched?
I would be very, like, into it. And then the second that we moved in, I'd be scared 24 hours a day. So I'd go in super confident. I'd be like, I'm totally fine. Totally going to be fine. This is going to be great. This is like, especially if it was just a beautiful house. And the moment that we moved in, I'd be like, and like my mental health would degrade and I would be scared all day, 24 hours a day, 100% of the time.
That's
what would happen.
I think that's a very honest answer.
Would you do it?
I would. I think I would with hesitancy because like, I was a kid who grew up pretty poor. Like getting a house for that cheap. I mean, I don't know what inflation is like these days.
Yeah.
But in that area of Long Island, the house looked really nice. It looked really well done.
Yeah, it was really cute, beautiful house.
And I mean, we're not the right people to ask that question.
Yeah,
we're
I weird guess that's anyway. True. Connor, would you do this?
No.
Immediately.
Very quick.
No hesitation.
Why? Why wouldn't you move in there?
I think that that I have so much of a constantly roaming mind at nighttime that it would just, even regardless of anything paranormal, that it would just make me so uncomfortable.
Mm.
Yeah.
To think about it.
I think that that's what would happen to me. But I think, which is smart. And all you're saying is that you know exactly how you're going to react once you're in there.
Here's the thing, too, about moving into places where crimes have been committed.
Yes.
They invite people to come in and clean that stuff, but it's sort of up to you.
Ooh, really?
A lot of that stuff. Oh, dude, have you never watched the people that are called in to take care of the stuff?
I've watched the cleaning up of stuff, but I didn't realize that like at a certain point, they're like, this is all you, my dude.
I have no doubt in my mind that there, before someone came to clean it up, before someone who is associated with the house, either the realtor had to do this or a family member, there was probably still like blood on the walls.
Oh no.
The fact that they left the furniture, there were bullet holes. Like they probably went through the bed and stuff.
Yeah.
So that stuff isn't it. The police don't take care of that for you.
Yeah. So you're taking care of that as the primary homeowner.
Yes. Like we were in this one hotel. And they had a bloody mattress that someone had died on.
They just left it there.
And it was still there.
Yeah.
No one takes care of that for you.
Okay. So they're going in with all of this information in their heads already. Even though they've bought the house for a great deal. It's beautiful. It's got a boathouse. It's got all this cool stuff. But no matter what, and I think it would be very difficult for most people, going into that scenario, that's going to be in your head a little bit.
Yeah.
They told the kids about it, right?
They did, but they waited until, I think, the day that they moved in. So, like, they were in the car, and they were like, listen, we got something we need to tell you.
Kids, you get your own bedrooms, but guess what? Someone died in them.
Yeah, like, I think that they waited until, like, literally they were pulling up to the house.
Their kids were young, too. They were, like,
10.
Were any of them teenagers at the time?
No, they were 9, 7, and 5.
So,
dude, can you imagine telling a little kid
no.
And then think about this. Even if they didn't tell them, you're gonna find out at school, kid.
Yeah, like the first kid you talk to on your block is gonna be like, you live in a murder house. Like that's definitely going to happen immediately.
Sure.
So they knew, like they had to probably prime their kids for this.
There's a documentary that came out a few years ago called My Amityville Horror. Mm-hmm. It's a documentary centered around Danny, who was the oldest child.
Yes.
And Danny claims that allegedly, George started to beat him after they moved into the house.
Yes, that he was very angry all the time, which kind of is in line with a lot of what the story talks about, how people's personalities were changing, like their attitudes were changing very drastically because remember, they were only supposedly living in the house for 28 days.
I have no doubt that if George was around, he would refute that.
Sure.
Again, I'm just saying this documentary is from Danny's perspective.
Yes.
Claims that George became abusive after they moved into the house.
Mm-hmm.
They started to notice that their toilets were turning black.
Yes. The sewing room was full of flies.
Yes.
Just like hundreds and hundreds of flies. And it was December, which was like very strange for that part of the country.
Really cold in New York.
Very cold. So like to have one room or to have, you know, a couple rooms in your house with like hundreds of flies in them, that's gross and scary.
According to the book and the films, George seemed to be the most affected by this, by this, whatever was happening in this house.
Yes.
In the, throughout the book, there's a long discussion about how a particular priest who they were already friends with, they invited to come and bless their house. And he just, something happened to him there where he basically told them, there's something wrong with your place. Yeah. I don't want to be there. In fact, the book paints him as the worst priest in the world.
He's kind of like, yeah, he's like basically goes to the house, has a really bad time, says there's something in the sewing slash yoga room, and then never comes back again and spends the whole rest of the book basically kind of chastising them. Yeah, and while also saying, peace, I'm not coming back.
I'm not coming back. Like,
I bounced. I'm not, I will not be returning to your home.
He got diarrhea.
He did get diarrhea.
Yeah, he did. He got diarrhea.
Yeah.
There's a lot of diarrhea in this book.
Weird, terrible smells, foul smells, like sewage.
Like diarrhea.
Like diarrhea. Sewage smell. It even affected the monastery that the priest was at.
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
So something in that house gave everyone diarrhea.
Everyone diarrhea.
This is where the really spooky stuff starts to occur. Yes. It's around this point, Missy. Yeah.
Missy
starts to see red eyes looking through her window.
And she makes a friend. And it's a friend we should all have. And it's Jody, my favorite being ever. Jody, the haunted, possibly demonic pig. I fucking love Jody.
Jody.
I stan Jody so hard. I'm all about Jody.
We're watching this stuff and Dana is literally chanting, Jody, Jody, Jody.
Jody didn't do anything wrong.
We would turn on. We watched like a couple movies, a couple different versions. We watched like a made for TV little doc thing. We listened to some of the book. And every time Jody appeared, Dana started the chant.
Jody, Jody,
Jody, Jody,
Jody. I'm team Jody. I'll be making t-shirts.
Jody did nothing wrong. You know, leave Jody alone.
I'm gonna make team Jody shirts, and I'm gonna give the proceeds to a pig sanctuary.
Oh, that's sweet.
Is that a good idea?
I think that's a great idea.
Listen, if you are actually following along, the only weird thing that Jody says to the little girl is, you're going to live in this house for the rest of your life, which, you know, is pretty creepy.
That's scary.
But also, like, the only other things, Jody was the only babysitter who was taking care of these children. Jody was hanging out with this little girl. Like, Jody was
true.
Jody was there to make sure that nothing bad happened. And everyone's scared because he's a pig.
When you look at when you look at depictions of Jody, I think one of the things was that there's a few scary things about Jody. I think one of the ones was that he had, was it teeth like a wolf and not like a pig?
In one of the movies, they said that she looked, that there was like a wolf looking through the window.
Yes.
But yeah, in the book and all the other accounts that I read, it was a pig.
It's a pig with red eyes.
Like a big pig.
Pigs are such sweet animals.
They are. And I love Jody. I don't give a crap about what anybody says.
Pictures don't look very sweet.
No.
Well, no. That was actually, that's a mask that was made for Amityville Awakening, which was a direct-to-video pseudo-sequel starring Bella Thorne? Is that her name?
I've never seen it.
Yeah, I don't think many people have.
That's not what Jody looked like.
No, Jody did not look like that at all. This is a slander.
Yes.
Poor Jody.
Poor Jody. I'm Jody's biggest fan.
Shortly thereafter, George started to notice hoof prints in the snow.
Yes.
I think that was like New Year's Day, New Year's Eve. There were footprints in the snow. Kathy, his wife, started to experience someone or something embracing her.
Yeah.
And then the smell of perfume.
Uh-huh. And a creepy feeling, sort of like, you know, something is basically like trying to communicate with her and her alone.
That's around the time the green ooze started.
Mm-hmm.
There was a green ooze that was coming off of the walls.
Are there a lot of instances, specifically maybe older cases, of like viscous fluids kind of? Because that's
very
not
common.
That's not a thing. You've experienced something like that.
Yeah, I've in our old house.
Yeah.
I had a weird viscous fluid drop onto my arm while I was editing video in the office.
So like it seems like something that is easy to laugh at because we hear green ooze is coming from the walls. Like that's gross. But like it's not an uncommon, like I don't want to say uncommon, but there's precedent in paranormal cases for these weird viscous fluids kind of appearing out of nowhere, which again happened to Greg one time.
Yeah. Speaking of viscous fluid.
Yeah. Oh God.
George starts spending a lot of time out in the boathouse.
Yeah. George is really, he's really out in that boathouse a lot. We don't know what he's doing out there.
It's a perfect little masturbation shack.
Yeah. I mean, and also there's the stress going on in his family. So you know that, you know, according to the beginning of the book, they were every single day.
He and Kathy aren't doing it very often.
No, he's got to head out to that boathouse.
Got to relieve some pressure out in the boathouse.
There's a lot of, pressure being released.
He gets mad. He gets frustrated. Yeah, and then he storms out of the house. And he's like, I'm going out to the boathouse.
Yes. And he's hanging in the boathouse.
He's hanging out in the boathouse.
And he's just becoming more introverted, elusive, not wanting to be around his family. Kind of mad. Didn't he grow a big beard? Wasn't that something that sort of just started happening?
Big bushy beard, and then he started hanging out at the Witch's Brew,
which sounds fucking awesome.
Yeah. The Witch's Brew is a local bar.
Shout out Witch's Brew.
And is the Witch's Brew still around?
I don't know if it's even real.
I'll look.
Let's find out if the Witch's Brew is still around. I'd love to go there if it is.
I would too. But yeah, so he's hanging out at the Witch's Brew, talking to the locals, getting to kind of like get more of a local perspective on what happened at the house.
They specifically call out that he drinks Miller Lite.
Yes.
So he goes to the Witch's
Shout
Brew.
Out Miller Lite.
Not a sponsor. Not yet anyway. And he goes to the bar, he's drinking his Miller Lite, and he notices that the bartender keeps staring him down.
Yes.
And finally, one day, he asks the bartender, like, what's the deal? And the guy goes, you look a lot like a guy who used to live in 112 Ocean Avenue.
Yeah, so George appears to be starting to take on a lot of the physical appearances of Ronnie Mayo.
He does look like him, though.
He does a lot. I mean, to be fair, that's what a lot of men looked like in the 70s. But he seems to be kind of taking on a lot of Ronnie DeFeo's physical features.
I don't know if it's real, but there is a Witch's Brew.
Oh, no, I'm looking here. It says, so there is a Witch's Brew, but it says that at the time in Amityville, there was no bar named the Witch's Brew, but that Ronnie DeFeo was a regular at Henry's Bar. So maybe that they had to change the name. That's another thing that they did in the book. They changed a bunch of names, which actually ironically got them into trouble.
Yes, they accidentally named one of the police officers an actual name of a police officer.
Who was from the area.
Yes.
Who then like sued them saying I had nothing to do with this.
He was like, I'm a real dude. Leave me out of this. Like, yeah. But they changed the name of the priest, and and that's kind of understandable. They're trying to protect people. They don't want, and I get that. That makes total sense. Yeah, George is looking like Ronnie DeFeo.
George is looking a lot like Ronnie DeFeo. His mood is terrible. Everyone's mood is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then he starts to notice Kathy floating above her bed.
Yes.
Like this is pretty extreme. This is going far beyond like black toilets and ghostly demonic pigs.
Yeah, this is like Ghostbusters stuff. Like there is no Dana, only
pre-Ghostbusters. This is pre-Ghostbusters.
It is pre-Ghostbusters.
In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if Ghostbusters took...
I mean, the ooze also.
Yeah.
The slime.
The ooze and the floating above the bed.
Yeah. Like, there's a lot of little nods to
interesting.
That.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
He notices Kathy floating above the bed. Her face gets lines in it like she's super old.
Like a crone, I believe they even called her like an old crone.
They're freaking out. Everything's terrible. And then the last couple things that happen to them is George starts hearing a marching band.
He did hear a marching band.
In the house over and over again.
Uh-huh.
They don't really know. I still don't understand what that was attached to.
I don't think that they ever even really reference it again after that. It's just like George heard a marching band. He was always cold.
Yeah.
So he was basically just chopping wood 24 hours a day and like trying to warm their house.
That's right.
Because that was one of the things that gets talked about a lot is how George was like chilled to the bone all the time.
Right.
Could not stay warm. And he couldn't even get warm at all in this whole house. So he just like obsessively would go out and chop wood.
The final straw for them was one night they see a white robed figure at the top of their stairs, and then they just peace out. Yeah. They're done.
They saw a scary white-robed person pointing at them, I believe. It was like they were pointing at them. And then they freaked out and they ran out of the house.
They left all their stuff.
Everything.
And they lasted 28 days in that house.
Yes.
And that was it. And during that time period, they'd had... they'd had some people come back and try and help them with psychic investigations, sure, and things like that. But that's pretty much the condensed version of the story.
Yes.
Of everything that happened to them while they were in that house. Those are the big moments.
Those are the big moments.
And the big deal is 28 days.
28 days.
That's all they could, that's all they could muster.
Yeah.
And then that was it. They fled in terror.
Mm-hmm. Then we get the book.
The Amityville Horror by Jay Anson.
Yes, and it was a cultural phenomenon.
Huge.
It was like the biggest thing ever. Every single person was talking about it.
Book clubs all over the country were reading this book. There's book club editions. You can still find book club editions of this. It was everywhere. It was advertised as scarier than The Exorcist, more real than The Exorcist. Mm-hmm. And the book obviously led to the movie. The movie was another cultural phenomenon, humongous deal. Mm-hmm. There were press tours. George and Kathy were on talk shows the stars of the movie. It was in all the tabloids. Everyone wanted a piece of the Amityville Horror. Mm-hmm. It was humongous. It cannot be overstated what a big deal this thing was for pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many sequels to the Amityville films.
Yes.
There's even sequels to the Amityville books. And they are entirely fictional. They have nothing to do with the original case.
Yeah.
There's actually weird legal ramifications of the movie and the book because they used a real place in the title.
Sure.
So for years, one of these loopholes that people have had is they can make an Amityville movie and just sort of allude that it has to do with the place because it was based on an ostensibly real event.
Yes.
At a real place.
Mm-hmm.
So there's even a movie that came out. There's two new movies. There's Amityville in Space and Amityville Karen. These are actual movies that were made that are tenuously connected to the event.
Sounds awful.
They're terrible.
Although Amityville in Space kind of sounds awesome.
The trailer, if you watch the trailer, it sounds awesome.
No.
It's not.
It's just
I'll Sharknado.
I'll suffer. I'll watch nothing but the trailer. I won't be able to make it through the movie.
Oh
it looks
my
so bad.
God.
That looks.
Oh Lord.
Woohoo.
It's
my God, it looks really bad.
It's just shot on a handy cam.
Yeah. I kinda wanna watch it. I'm not lying.
Well, maybe we should.
Oh my God. My God. It's blasting off into space.
Yeah, it looks bad.
Oh, what is Space Jody like? Is Space Jody in this movie? Did they give Jody like a space suit?
I hope so.
Right.
You know, the irritating thing about some of these movies is they don't really talk about Jody very much.
I know, Jody.
In the remake, the Ryan Reynolds remake.
There's no Jody?
Jody is turned into a little girl.
Oh.
Yeah, so they don't use a demonic pig.
Well, isn't it in the actual story, didn't the Lutz family think that Jody was the apparition on the stairs that pointed at them? And like, wasn't there something along the lines of like being connected with that?
I think so. There are a lot of different theories. Even Jay Anson at the end of the book that he writes, he presents a few different theories on what could be going on in Amityville because there's never been any real clear answer. There's a lot of people who've tried to provide them, but nothing really great.
There's one little detail that I feel like they kept trying to bring it back to, which was in the basement, there was a trap wall that kind of like was behind a place where they were like a pantry.
Right.
And they pushed the wall sort of out of the way and they found this like red room.
Right.
So the red room is this mysterious room. They didn't know anything about it. They didn't know why it was there, but it was painted red and Satan stuff happened there. And like, but there's, and sort of they, I remember at one point George talking to the bartender at the Witch's Brew and he was like, yeah, I catered an event there once and there was like right. Satan people in there doing Satan stuff.
Oh, I think they alluded to it being a place where sacrifices of animals
were
conducted.
That was the idea, right? Which is why Jody is a pig. Maybe I'm Jay piecing Anson, this together. I don't know.
Jay Anson at the end of the book of says that that Jody and the white robed figure are one and the same.
Okay.
But he also claims that there was the ghost of a former tenant and a little boy.
Yes,
that
that's
were in
right.
the house.
Yeah. We got a little bit of everything here. We got we got ghost kids. We got pigs. We got all sorts of stuff.
Well, then we have Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are invited. There's a big news.
Oh, my Lord.
There's a big newscast that's going to happen. So they invite a couple different psychics. They invite Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yes. Mary Downing. Is that her name?
Downey. Mary Downey Pascarella, I think was her name. They invite her, which has to have been hilarious, because if you've ever been around a couple of
dueling psychics
who are trying to outdo one another. We've been in these situations before, and there's a performance aspect to it.
Oh my God, completely. I can't.
And when you get two of those people together, it is just chaos. They're constantly one-upping one another.
Yes.
I would love to have been at that table to see that, how they were responding to one another.
I think it was a bit of a shit show. I think the funny thing is that the news people were like, nothing happened. Like, they didn't expect
that is the funny
anything.
Thing. They spent 6 hours. I think one of the newscasters even said, he said in one of his opening remarks that the 2 hours he spent in the theater dealing with the rowdy teens was far scarier than the 6 hours he spent at that seance.
Yeah.
So
nothing, and like, here's the thing, to play devil's advocate, as paranormal investigators and people who spend time in places that are supposedly haunted, you can't make things happen. You can't force things to happen. Sometimes they just don't. I've been in some of the most haunted places in the world and nothing's happened.
And of course.
So that's to be fair.
Right.
But you're also, you have to imagine that this was like a media moment. So they've got all of these people who are trying to turn the moment into their moment, right? So Ed is saying a legion of demons just flew through my body, and like, Lorraine's walking, you know, so
Lorraine's going,
it's close to hell as I've ever been.
It's the closest to hell that I've ever been.
And then
saying that whatever evil, this is the thing that sticks out to me. There's an ancient evil from the bowels of the earth.
Yes. So it's just kind of, you have to imagine that these are people who are definitely trying to make the moment their moment. And so it's just
a complete
shit show. And not a lot of factual information is learned about what potentially is going on in this location.
There is one thing that happened that night that was genuinely pretty creepy.
I think it's still, when I see it, gives me the Wiggins big time.
This episode is brought to you by the Newkirk Museum of the Paranormal Membership Program. Become a museum member and take part in live paranormal investigations. Receive Dana's Magic of the Month subscription box, access in-depth artifact case files, and gain access to hundreds of hours of exclusive content available only to members. To become a member, visit patreon.com/paramuseum.
They set up motion activated cameras.
Yes.
Infrared cameras.
Yeah.
Which at the time that's no small feat.
No.
Because like today we think of ghost hunting television shows and they're all shot night vision. This was a lot different back then.
And it was just all night long taking photos. Static cameras all around the house, just boom, 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 taking pictures while they do their thing.
At one moment, the camera tripped. And when they got the film developed, there is what appears to be an image of a young boy with glowing eyes.
Yeah, I'm literally getting goosebumps.
There it is.
I hate it. It's very scary looking. Like, there's tons and tons of photos of this hallway. There's tons of just totally normal pictures. And then out of the blue, you get this random, I mean, it's pretty stunning. The other detail is obviously for, you know, there's no children in the house at all.
Right. And even the newscasters have said there were no kids in that house at that time.
Yes.
They've gone on record talking about this.
You have to, you know, imagine that there was a lot of people in the house at the time. You know, again, to play devil's advocate, could they have snuck a kid in the house and taken a photo?
Like a lot of work.
It does seem like a lot of work, but it also seems like something that potentially could have gone bad very fast because you have too many people. It's like, I think it'd be easy to say like, oh, they could sneak it in there because there's so many people, but there's too many people to do something like that. You know what I mean? Like, I think that the chances of that probably weren't very high.
Old infrared cameras definitely will do that to even like a normal person's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But it is scary looking for sure.
Yeah. I think, isn't there...
There's one skeptical argument that comes up again and again about this photo, and it is that that is actually one of their news camera guys.
Okay.
And he is peeking out the door because he doesn't want to disturb anyone or anything that's going on. I mean, you watch paranormal television shows, you'll catch crew people in the background all the time.
Yeah.
A lot of them will try and play it off like, no, that was a Bigfoot. They'll actually play the footage and say, oh, that was Bigfoot or that was a ghost or whatever. But it's usually crew people. That does not look like a full-grown man.
It really doesn't. First things first, it would be super cool if we could like see all the people who were crew. Like if there were photos. I'm sure there's photos of them.
Yeah.
But it does look like a little boy. Like it looks like a little boy in a plaid shirt kind of peeking out around the corner. Mm-hmm. And like, I think
you can look at other photos in this sequence too, and you'll see Ed and Lorraine and other news reporters out in the hall, and they are far taller.
Yes.
So I don't know.
Even look at the head size. Like that doesn't look like an adult's head. It looks like a kid's. It looks like a little kid.
The features are very soft. For our audio listeners, if you just Google Amityville Ghost Boy,
you'll find
the photos. They're everywhere. It's very easy to find.
Do it at night when you're by yourself.
Yes.
And get scared. It's very fun.
That is other than some of the crazy claims like, you know, Lorraine talking about evil from the bowels of hell, being close to hell, Ed saying a legion of demons flew through him.
Yeah.
That's really the only thing that happened the night that they did that 6-hour investigation.
Yes, that was seance. That was basically the only... Oh, Connor found a plaid shirt guy.
Ah, there's that. See, this is part of the argument.
That's interesting.
The guy they're saying, maybe.
Yep.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Weird. I mean, that's very close for our audio listeners. Connor's found a picture of a crew member.
Who was that? Can you click on that and tell us who that guy is? It's a side profile of a guy, who's wearing what looks to be a very close approximation of the same shirt in the Ghost Boy photograph. There's arguments that the Ghost Boy is one of the DeFeo kids. I think John,
yes,
the youngest one.
I think so. I think that's what we think.
Paul Bartz.
So it's either a little Ghost Boy or it's Paul Bartz.
Paul Bartz, you've it up for everybody.
Well, who knows? We don't know.
Possibly. Allegedly.
Allegedly. We don't know the truth.
Yeah.
We never will unless Paul Bartz comes out and shows other photos of him on that day.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, if they had like a crew, like a bag of like camera equipment down on the ground, he could have been leaning down to pick up some camera equipment or like you said, kind of sneaking through. It's entirely possible. Or maybe they wanted to drum up a cool picture for the magazine or for the newspaper.
Let's talk about some of the sketchier stuff around the case.
We kind of have been.
It's hard not to because it's a weird case.
Yes.
It's a popular case. There's tons of opinions on it.
Yes. And there were a lot of people kind of involved, not necessarily in the things that happened inside the house, but there were a lot of people involved in all of the things that happened directly afterwards. So from the book being written to the media stuff to all of it, there was a lot of like very big personalities that became characters in this story.
I think that the most persuasive piece of skeptical evidence against this case, or at least the one that has persuaded the most people, the one you hear the most, has to do with the early involvement of William Weber in the case.
Who was Ronnie DeFeo's defense lawyer. He alleged that he had a recording. One night he was getting bombed with the Lutzes. They were popping bottles and getting real drunk.
I think this was over the course of 6 nights.
Was it? Okay.
Something like that. There were many nights that they sat together and talked about how, because I guess, didn't he say he'd been approached already about book rights to the DeFeo case?
Yes, I think that was what it was. And he spent some time with them and getting drunk and basically allegedly as a kind of team, they collectively came up with the idea to not only write the book, but for a lot of the things that happened in the book. Like an example that he gives is when they moved in, there were still fingerprint marks on the walls from when the they were doing fingerprinting, and they joked like, oh, there's the green slime, because it was like a darker color, as if like that was sort of the inspiration for the green slime, which it was again allegedly something that actually happened in the house. Can we have an alleged counter on this episode?
It's just such a safeguard for us.
Yeah,
it's such a comfortable word.
It really, really
like
is.
It brings me comfort when you say it.
Sure. Connor's
knowing the comments.
Connor's blood pressure goes down every time we say the word allegedly. But yeah, so apparently they were all coming up with this story together, and it was with the idea of writing a book and you know, making some cash off of this story.
I think, what was it, George got he made like $200,000
something. I think I remember hearing that. Yeah.
I mean, that's what most of the research says, somewhere around there. I'm curious, could you find out what that would be in today's amount of money?
Yeah.
Because that was the 70s, what, 74, 75?
I'm also curious what 80 grand was back then, because I'd love to know like how much they actually would have bought a house for compared to today.
Inflation is a weird thing, but I have a feeling, again, we'll never see another Amityville Horror because the amount of money that they got from this is insane.
Yes.
When you look at what people sell their rights for these days, wow.
So $440,000.
That's almost 80 grand.
Is the purchase price of the house.
Oh, wow.
So they paid almost $500,000 for that house.
For that house. Which,
that's not that tracks.
Yeah, it kind of does. I mean,
in that area, I mean, I bet the houses in that area are millions of dollars at this point.
And they had a boathouse. It's on a lake. Like, it's got a great yard. It's
Jesus
a really nice house.
Christ.
I mean, that's a million.
$200,000 in 1975 is equivalent to the purchasing power of about $1.1 million today.
One mil.
That's their quote.
I got 1 mil, to be a part of the Amityville book.
Even if they do a bad job, they're gonna make that 1.1 mil.
Let's see how many people get what we're referencing.
That is a shitload of money.
Yeah,
I cannot imagine
that's
someone making that
stacks
for their paranormal story. When truthfully, like, you gotta understand, you might not know this if you haven't worked in production in these shows. Most of these shows that are like recreation shows, My Ghost Story, like whatever the new ones are, they're paying these people like $500.
Yeah, it's not
for the rights to their story. Yeah. And they can do whatever they want with it in perpetuity. $500 versus $1.1 million.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. And they all had something to benefit too, right? Because like the idea was that DeFeo's lawyer who was about to be presenting the case in court, was trying to get an insanity defense, and it also being spurred on by like there were voices in his head. He was told to do this by evil spirits.
That's
so having the family that moved in right after also corroborating that there were evil spirits.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's admissible in court would be another question. I don't think it got to that point, but it's like that would be another backup for him.
Yeah. Right.
And then he would also be able to allegedly profit off of the book as well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then after the book came out and it was like a huge hit, there were like lawsuits back and forth.
Well, yeah. George, in one of the documentaries that we watched, Dana found a really great documentary that was from
the BBC.
It was Channel 4.
Okay.
UK's Channel 4. It's really weird because they used an Eminem song as the end credits.
It was very... It was very tonally strange.
It was a totally strange documentary, but it was great. It was really great. Provided a lot of both sides.
Yeah, and they talked to, again, a lot of those characters that became parts of these stories.
George said in that documentary that before anything happened, William Weber gave him a contract that said Ronnie DeFeo would get like 5%.
Yes, that's
of anything.
Right.
I think it was
5%
of anything. And George was like, this is weird. No. And then they just ghosted William Weber.
Yeah, then they were like,
no.
Yeah.
And that's part of what made William Weber mad.
Yes.
Is that he believed, allegedly, that the Lutzes took elements of the stories that they'd come up with together,
yeah,
and then made the book and profited off of them.
Yeah, they cut them out.
Yeah.
They cut them out. They did. They just took the idea and cut them out, allegedly.
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 I think I think that all the lawsuits were thrown out at some point.
Okay.
I found it. It was the real Amityville Horror.
The real...
I like that Connor calls it Amityville.
Amityville, sorry.
No,
I like it. It's good.
It's just...
That's how we'll get around the copyright. No. It's not Amityville. It's Amityville.
Yeah, we were talking about Amityville. Yeah.
It's 2005 documentary. Yeah. Sounds about right. It was good. It was like kind of...
Oh, God.
There's going to be some crime there's scene real photos. Oh, no!
There's actual crime scene photos in this.
Maybe don't show that part.
It was really great. If you're really curious about all the sides, if you want more, we'll link it in the description.
Mm-hmm.
You can go check it out. It's great. It's just on YouTube.
112 Ocean Avenue. Do you think that was Yellow Card's inspiration?
Oh, Ocean Avenue?
Their hit song.
I wasn't a big Yellow Card fan.
Yeah, I'm not either.
I know of it,
though.
It's
their one-hit wonder.
It was the big deal. Yeah. I don't know. Well, apparently Eminem had an Amityville song, too. So,
yeah.
This is a big... See? Cultural... Phenomenon.
Shout out Eminem.
Shout out Eminem. Shout out Yellow Card.
You want to give him a shout out? I think he could use it.
Yeah. He definitely needs me giving him a shout out. Shout out Eminem.
You know, I don't think a lot of people know this, especially if you're not like in the Eminem fan club.
I am not, actually.
No, I don't. None of us are. He actually started, this shows that Eminem has a good sense of humor. He started a restaurant in downtown Detroit that's called Mom's Spaghetti.
Yeah, I think it's very funny.
It's very funny.
It is very funny. I am on board.
Although, Connor did make a good point when we were talking about this the other day.
Yeah, he came on the radio and I was like, and you were like, he made a restaurant called Mom's Spaghetti. And I was like, but he threw up Mom's Spaghetti.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know.
Bringing us back to tonight's focal point, diarrhea.
Diarrhea. We should start an Amityville-based restaurant gives you food poisoning.
That's a bad idea.
I can't say this enough.
They say it
literally,
so many times.
The first quarter of the book is nothing but George having diarrhea.
It's literally like 8-9 times they talk about his explosive,
so insane
butt bombs. Oh, like just
God.
All over this book.
It's really embarrassing, actually.
It is super embarrassing.
Well, they did make $1.1 million.
Yeah, it was fine. They're fine. They're off of George's diarrhea. Yeah. That's some of the sketchy stuff. The other little detail that I wanted to point out, because it has to do with Jody, and as we all know, I'm obsessed with Jody. Apparently, the next door neighbors had a big Persian cat that Ronnie DeFeo called Pig because it was a big cat. Mm. And he would often jump up and look in the window, which was Missy's bedroom window.
That's really fascinating to me.
Yeah.
For a couple different reasons.
Yeah.
Here, Missy never met Ron DeFeo.
No, ever. No.
No, I'm assuming she probably didn't have a whole lot of contact with the neighbors and stuff like that.
Likely not, as a very small child at this point.
So a little kid saying, I've got a friend who's a pig.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Jody.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks in my windows. He has red eyes. Like the cat specifically had red
glowing
eyes that
red
glowed
eyes.
When the light hit them.
Yeah.
Some cats do.
It was like a white Persian cat.
Yeah.
And like they usually have blue eyes. And so they get really like, their eyes look very red in the dark.
So did the kid intuit?
Yeah.
The nickname?
Yeah.
Was there something that was lingering there? This is something that fascinates me about this case is
mm-hmm.
no one was talking to the kids.
No, they were
it's
like
it's all from
them out.
George and Kathy's perspective.
Yes.
The kids were experiencing some of the scariest shit. They were watching their moms and their dads start to lose their minds. They
uh-huh.
allegedly, according to Danny,
mm-hmm.
Were being reprimanded physically more often than before.
It's very strange because normally that's, at least in more recent years, if children are involved, like think about, you know, Enfield Poltergeist or like so many cases that really revolved around kids. Like it became such a, almost again, like a trope that it's kind of weird that no one has ever really listened to them.
No.
And like they have a lot to say about their experiences.
We have met one of the children.
Yes.
We've met Christopher. Yeah. Christopher Lutz.
Which was the youngest boy.
He was the youngest boy. He actually came to one of our museum exhibitions and wanted to see the plank.
Yeah.
And when I showed it to him, it looked like he was traumatized.
Yeah.
Like he got really quiet. Uh-huh. He kind of like sat there. He stared right at it. He nodded his head and he kind of went, And then he just turned around and walked away. He didn't say anything to me. And I was like, well, that was really strange.
Yeah.
And when you watch My Amityville Horror, the documentary about Danny, Danny had some very strong opinions about George.
Yes.
Claimed that there was weird paranormal stuff happening around George all the time.
Yeah, that was even before they moved into the house, he had seen George doing weird things.
Doing weird stuff.
Things happening around him.
He was talking about how he witnessed the paranormal activity there. Chris talks about how there was definitely paranormal activity there. It was just it was just exaggerated.
Yes. Danny at one point talks about before moving into the house, when they lived in the house before, coming home from school, walking into the garage, and George was in the garage with some of his friends, and he was making a wrench levitate in the air. And he said it took him a few seconds. He would put his hands over top of it and like it would lift up, and then he would like move it across the room to another desk and set it down again. I mean, you know, kids remember things weird. They were going through a divorce at that point. It could have been stress. There's a lot of possible explanations for it, but it's an interesting detail that is often just like overlooked.
This is the other weird thing. I have independently heard stories about George just being weird, like weird paranormal stuff happening around George.
Yeah.
I've heard stories about him walking into a room and then everyone sees a green aura around him.
Okay.
I've heard this from multiple people. I've heard that George could levitate stuff. A good friend of mine, Jason Gallen, was pretty close with George before George died. And Jason has told me stories about how George was trying to teach him how to do that, how to levitate stuff with his mind. He was one of the people that saw George glowing green, walks into a hotel room at an event, because George was still doing, he was doing lecture tours and stuff like that late into his life. He was glowing green. Jason swears by this, that happened. I heard another one of my friends, Jen, used to talk about, because she was close with George too. They did like paranormal investigations together. He was training her to be some kind of protege. Jen would talk about how George's ultimate goal was to create a school for psychic kids in like New Mexico, I think, or Arizona, somewhere in the Southwest. So he's trying to be the real Professor X.
Yeah, that's cool.
George was a weird dude. There was weird stuff that was happening with him.
But that doesn't mean that he's, you know, even if he was into transcendental meditation and all that kind of stuff, that doesn't necessarily mean that he was evil.
Well, this is my argument.
Yes.
I think that the Amityville Horror was, I think stuff was actually happening in that house to those people. I'm a big proponent of haunted people, not haunted houses. I think that something was going on there. It got exaggerated. And people decided to, because of the murder that occurred in that house, to put everything that happened on the house.
Yes.
But I really do believe
there
was something strange about George.
Yes.
I'm not saying it was evil, but there was something about him or his presence. Maybe the house changed him. I don't know. That caused weird stuff to happen.
Yeah. You said something yesterday that has never dawned on me literally at all until you mentioned it, and it didn't dawn on me because you told me. But it's this theory that like almost seems bizarre that no one may, and maybe people have come to this conclusion, but I've never seen it. But we're also talking about three young children who are going through an emotionally traumatic moment in their lives. Their parents got divorced. They have a new stepdad. They're moving to a new place. They're moving into a new house. Those are things that often can cause poltergeist activity. Like it's not uncommon again, when
you
when
have a bunch of young kids
yeah.
who are starting to go through puberty, they're yes. around that time.
They're starting to get there.
Yep. And they're the ones that are experiencing so much stuff. They're talking to the pig.
Yeah.
They're talking to Jody.
Exactly. Like
they're watching weird stuff happen with their parents. There's, you know, Danny makes no bones about it in that documentary where he was like, I wanted to kill George.
Mm-hmm.
Like he said that. Mm-hmm. He hated George.
He was an angry little boy. And I mean, he was, again, his parents got divorced. There's this new guy in his life. He
right.
doesn't know who this guy is. He's weird. And he's making his mom move to, like, so much energy
right.
is just being, like, constantly just emanating off of these kids. And they're stressed and they're in a new place and they don't know what's going on. Like, you know, we think about, again, like I mentioned earlier, the Enfield poltergeist case. It's poltergeist activity happening around young children. A lot of things that potentially could have been happening around these people might have had something to do with that, or it was adding to whatever was going on there.
Right.
And making it worse.
Nobody's talking to the kids.
Yeah. It just seems really weird.
It's so strange to me.
Yeah. It does seem very strange. It seems
and
like...
here's the other thing. The kids, they'll be the ones to tell on you.
Sure.
So if there is funny business happening,
yeah.
they're going to be the first ones to say it. But even today...
yeah.
The kids who are talking about it, Danny and Chris, they're saying, no, there was stuff happening in that house.
Yeah.
I remember it
they're
was happening in
that house.
They're
not denying that weird shit went down.
They're saying things were exaggerated for the yeah. sake of books and movies, but that stuff was actually happening there. But nobody talked to him back then.
Yeah.
It's
very weird.
You know what, though? This is, this is driving me crazy because I only have bits and pieces of this. I'm going to see if Jason will take my call. I'm going to call him and I'm going to see if he'll talk to
us
about
George. We're
going to
get the lowdown. We're going to get some
Jason.
Tea right now.
It's not very often that you have someone who actually like knew this guy
yeah.
that you can talk to.
I found an article. Yeah. Chris said that there were shadow figures that he remembers seeing, but not any of the really insane stuff.
He said, George Lutz was extremely curious of everything paranormal and tried to summon supernatural beings by chanting. Quote, I don't know that I'd call it black magic, but it was a way to call up spirits, he said.
So maybe they were doing some spiritualism stuff.
I mean sure.
It was the 70s, baby. Everybody
exactly.
Everybody was drinking road beers and talking to demons.
I mean, kind of. All right, here. Let me see if I can get Gowan to tell us about George. Let's see. Put him on speaker. Does this sound okay?
Hello,
Jason. You're on the you're on the podcast, so don't say anything too crazy.
I guarantee nothing, my friend. I guarantee nothing.
Listen, we're talking about the Amityville plank in our collection, and I started to think about you because you had a relationship with George, and
I did.
It's up to you if you want to talk about this or not. We'll cut this out if you're not into it. We're talking about the case, and we're talking about the difference between like haunted houses and haunted people. And I've thought for a long time that there is some truth to this case. I just thought it was less focused on the house and more focused on George. And you had told me some pretty weird stories about things that you had seen or experienced around him. Is that something, would you talk about that or elaborate on that?
Absolutely. He's dead. He's not going to do it now. I mean,
okay. the one thing that always sticks out in my mind is I remember the night that George passed away. You lived about like half an hour from me. You said, hey, I'm having a rough time. Let's, you know, do you mind meeting up and we can just kind of talk? And so we met at the Dandy Mini Mart in Towanda?
Yes, when it was still had a Pizza Hut Express in it.
That's it. We sat and we ate pizza. Shout out Pizza Hut. Not a sponsor, not yet. and you started telling me a story, and the one that always sticks with me is you saw George glowing. Do you remember this?
Oh, absolutely. Happened in North Carolina. I have actually a couple stories in North Carolina about him because I traveled with him. I was, you know, one half of his camera team for that summer, and we did a bunch of dates. And so this one night, we were in the hotel room in Hickory, North Carolina, and I felt this overwhelming urge to go and talk to him. And so I went over to his hotel room, which was across the hall, and he's like, "Oh, good, you got the message." And he's like, I just sort of sent you a message telepathically that I needed you to come in here." I'm like, "Sure you did." And so he's like, "Sit in, I want to talk to you." And he kind of talked to me about, you know, my struggles growing up kind of stuff. And he's like, "I think that you have some gifts that we need to talk about. Hold on, I need to get Tim Yancey over here." And Tim Yancey, who, you know, he passed away last year, is a very, very close friend of mine. Was also staying in the room with me. He was the other, George's other camera guy. And he's like, "Hold on, let me send him a message that he's getting here." And like, he like literally like put his hand to his head, like Professor X from the X-Men. And I'm like, sure, this is going to work. And Greg, within minutes, Tim Yancey literally came to the door. And he's like, "I don't know, I felt like I should come over here." And he's like, "Good, you got the message, sit down." I'm like, "Okay, that's weird." And so he said to me and Tim, you know, he's like, "There's things that I haven't told you guys about me that I think it's time you know." He's like, "I need to teach you about, you know, meditational techniques that I think will help you with the stuff that we're dealing with, which is very negative entities." Because what we were doing is we were going around to houses. He was kind of filming a documentary because he had stepped out of the spotlight for almost 2 decades.
Right.
Because, you know, the Amityville Horror, like the emotional side of that had, you know, kind of taken its toll on him. And so he stepped out of the thing and he was getting back out there. We were doing cases and we were, you know, filming a lot of this stuff. So he's like, "I need to teach you how to protect yourself." And he starts meditating. And Greg, and I know you've heard the story, but like he started to glow this bright, like green color. And nice. I'm like, "What the hell am I seeing?" And like, I kept, like, you know how if you stare at something for a long time, sometimes like if you move, like it carries the image.
Sure.
Like, cause it's just the scientific, you know, biology of your eyes or physiology of your eyes. And when I like rubbed my eyes and looked back, it was still there. I was like, "Oh no, that's there." And I raised my hand. I'm like, "I don't want to interrupt you, but you're glowing right now." And Tim Yancey looked at me. He's like, "You can see that?" And George says, "Oh, you both can see that. Perfect. That's exactly what I was trying to do." He's like, "And now look what I can do with it." And he was like making it move and take different shapes. And I'm like, "Whoa, WTF, what am I seeing here?" And I, you know, he's like, "You have the ability to do this too." And like, he was like trying to teach me how to do this. And like, I'm like, and like, we lived probably 12 hours away from mm-hmm. this, and I was so freaked out by what I saw that weekend. After that, the aura that was around him, the stuff that he did, I drove home in the middle of the night. I drove home 12 wow. hours at like 2 o'clock in the morning because I was just like so rattled. I was like, "I have to go. I can't do this right now." The same night, but earlier, he did a book signing at a Barnes & Noble, which, you know, and he told me only 2 times publicly did he ever talk about the last night and what happened. And he told the story more in depth. And he told a story about the last night. And I watched it, like the shape of his face started changing. And like, I kept, again, I'm like, what is happening? And I looked at Tim Yancey and he nodded to me like, "Yes, I see what you're seeing." But like his head almost like expanded, like one of those, you know, like those little pellets you pop into water and they grow into like a sponge dinosaur or whatever kind of thing. And like his head was expanding like that. And I was just like, that whole weekend was just a crazy, and that was the last time I saw him in person.
Jason, what did you think when you were seeing this? Like you said, we've seen lots of crazy stuff, but this is another level. What was going through your mind when you were watching this happen?
I couldn't. couldn't process it. Like, I literally can't tell you what I was thinking, because I was trying to, like, just grab the straws as to what this was. Because I tried to look for the most simple explanation that I was like, well, I didn't take any drugs. I didn't take anything that anybody slipped me anything. I just was trying to, like, rationalize what I was seeing. But, like, there it was. And it wasn't just me. And, like, I was like, yeah, I think that the devil might be deep in this. And, like, something's going on. Like, this is not normal. And I had such a, like I said, it affected me so deeply that I had a 12-hour drive home. Just, and the only thing I thought about that entire time was, what did I just see? And and you don't want to know the last thing he said to me.
Yeah.
The last thing he said to me before he died, he called me on the phone 2 days before. And he
He died.
Correct.
Wow.
He said, you know, after I go, I want you to be the one who vindicates my story. I want you to be the one that goes out there and teaches people about what I was really about. The problem is, and the problem you're always going to struggle with, is you will never know who I really was.
Oh.
And he's like, that's a mystery that you need to figure out. You may not ever get there, but I need you to know I love you. And, you know, one of the things for him, and what the last lawsuit that he had with MGM, that, like, and the thing that caused the heart attack that killed him, you know, the day he died was the day they got the verdict on the lawsuit from MGM. And they're like, he had such a problem with the way he was portrayed in the film, especially with Ryan Reynolds. And he took it personally because, you know, he was a huge animal lover.
Right.
And they portrayed it that he killed the dog in the Ryan Reynolds version of the film. And
yeah.
Harry lived like a long, like, even that dog was around for a very long, long time.
Right.
And died of natural causes. And he had such an issue with that part of it. And just like the monster that he was portrayed as.
Yeah, it seemed like it was like a character assassination in a lot of ways. Like, it really did paint him in a very different kind of light.
There's an interview out there somewhere where Ryan Reynolds was interviewed about talking about what it was like to play George Lutz. And I remember this affected him deeply when Ryan Reynolds said, well, the guy's not going to win any Godfather of the Year awards.
Ooh.
And George just like...
Yeah.
It truly wounded him on such a level because he, you know, he was estranged from Danny and Christopher. He was good with his daughter, with him and Kathy's daughter, Missy, but also, you know, he was good with his own daughters, Gabrielle, and the other one escapes my name right now, but Gabby and whatever her name was. But he took it so personally because he did feel so attacked.
What do you think, in your estimation, you knew George, you were friends with him. What, was it the house or was it George?
Both.
Yeah?
Mm.
What
it
do
was
you...
both. I think they chose that. I think they chose that house for a very specific reason.
Ah.
This is just kind of my personal take after years of, you know, spending time with this. I think that they chose that house for a very specific reason. They knew what happened there. They knew this, you know, what happened. George was practicing transcendental meditation. He was, you know, look, I have accepted, you know, he never kind of painted it this way, when he was alive, but I within my heart of hearts, you know, Christopher Lutz and I are very good friends. Christopher Quarantino, we're good friends.
Right.
And he and I have had long discussions about what George was into. He was a practicing occultist. He did.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way he was doing the things he did and saw the things he saw and things escalated the way they did without him having done something. He did. There's just, I have accepted that. And it goes back to, you know, what he said, I will always wonder who you are, or you'll always wonder who I was. Yes, and I struggle with it, because he was like a dad figure to me.
Sure.
But I know that there was, you know, he was trying to channel stuff.
Mm.
And so, you know, he was accepting things into him that, you know, and it, I think it got away from them. I think they underestimated what that house was capable of producing.
Jason, thank you so much for picking up and talking about this.
I love seeing you guys.
Well, I will call you after the podcast and we'll catch up.
Sure. Sounds great.
All right, man. Thank you again.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Yeah, we'll talk to you later. See you, dude. Well, there you have it.
Interesting. See that? But now I'm conflicted. See, because here's the thing. If George Lutz was a practicing occultist, no wonder he's keeping that shit under wraps.
Sure.
Because it's the 70s. It's like, it's only just starting to become something that's a part of like the, you know, the sort of popular way of thinking. And even then, everyone's still in those spaces is just calling you a devil worshiper or a Satanist or black magician or whatever else it is that they're coming up with.
Sure. So they do that today.
It's literally still happening.
They still do that today.
So maybe this man had an interest in the occult and was a practicing occultist, in which case I like this even more than I did in the beginning, and I'm much more fascinated.
We should have asked
it.
Jason what he thought about Jody.
God damn
it. Hold on, I'm going to text him while you keep talking.
All right. So I think that if anything, you know, having that new perspective, we're talking about a series of events that happened after a practicing occultist moved into a very weird house, and that perfect combination kind of happened. Like, maybe there were rituals that were going on. Maybe there was some kind of trance channeling, in which case, I'm fascinated. I want to know more about this. Like,
well, we know, you know, weird stuff can happen when you're in a trance state.
Absolutely.
Like, you can, I truly believe that when you go into these places, you can affect change around you.
Yeah.
That's what magic is.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
A change in the environment is a big deal.
Are you in possession of a haunted object? An antique spiritualist tool? Wreckage from a crashed UFO? The Newkirk Museum of the Paranormal wants to add it to their archives. Whether your strange item is causing you paranormal problems or is simply a supernaturally significant relic worthy of curation, we want to hear from you. For more information on our acquisition process, visit paramuseum.com.
I think it's fascinating that it sounds like there were two things happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
They coalesced, but everyone focused on the one thing.
Yes. And I think a lot of that has to do with, and again, this is just my opinion, but maybe it's because they didn't want to talk publicly about being practicing occultists because everyone under the sun would call them Satan worshipers.
Sure.
And probably burn their house down or like be, you know what I mean? Like attack them publicly. Like all of the things that happen when in the mid to early 70s, you say, I'm an occultist.
Right.
There's a very small group of people at that point in time who even understand what it is you're saying.
Right.
You've got people like the Warrant. All of those people are coming at it from a demon, satanic, like they're bringing that satanic panic into it. So maybe these were people who went in. I mean, the detail that I always thought was really interesting, specifically in the book, is that Kathy refers to her sewing room as her sewing and yoga room.
Right.
So they were practicing yoga. Again, we know
there were a lot
practicing
of people, like religious people back then,
uh-huh.
Catholics, hardcore Christians.
Yes.
I mean, there's still many that my parents thought that stuff was a gateway to the demonic.
Sure. And like, you know, maybe that's just a little bit of insight into what their hobbies and their interests were.
Right. Even the stuff that we've seen people experience with the plank hasn't been much.
No.
But the stuff that we've experienced has been more related to the DeFeo murders than anything to do with the Amityville horror case.
Uh-huh.
There was a moment that happened. We were at, where were we? We were at Mackinac Island.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing an event with Strange Escapes at Mackinac Island. And there's always a crowd around the museum. Whenever we have the museum set up, there's always a crowd. People get frustrated sometimes because it's hard to get through because we want people to handle the items. We want them to touch them. We want them to experience them. So sometimes what people will do is they'll wait till one of the speakers is lecturing.
Yeah, when it's nice and quiet.
And then they'll come out and they kind of get a private showing
mm-hmm.
at that point if they're not interested in the lecture that was going on. There was a woman who was doing just that. She came out into the hall that we were set up in and she just wandering around, taking photos of the stuff, getting up close. Yeah, she asked us a few questions. We were the only ones in the hall. It was just you and me and her.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else was watching the lecture. And then she leaves. She goes back. maybe an hour later, she comes back to us. She's like, you need to look at this photo that I took of the plank. And she shows us this image. And it's you can tell it's like taking a picture through glass. You get the reflection in the background.
Yes. Yeah.
And she zooms in and she points to what looks like the sort of blurry reflection of a young girl who is, she looks like she's leaning.
Kind of around a corner almost.
I found a picture.
There it is. There's the photo of it. And, you know, it's typical ghosty stuff. It looks like a little girl. She's got like high boots on. You can see her knees. She's looks like she's wearing a skirt.
Her hair looks dark.
And looks like she's wearing some kind of a coat or something, like a sweater maybe.
Over top of like a little jumper sort of.
Yeah.
Like you can sort of see almost, if you look, the jumper looks like it's probably like a grayish kind of color. And you can see the spot between like her little knees and like the top of her little socks and stuff like that.
The weird thing is, it's very stereotypically ghost photo.
Yes.
You can, if you really push yourself,
you can see it.
Mm-hmm. If you decide not to, it's a smudge.
Yes.
One of those types of things.
Yeah.
When you look at it, if you see a little girl, it looks like she's wearing like a Catholic schoolgirl uniform.
Yeah, like a school uniform. She's got her little socks. She's got her little like penny loafer shoes.
Well, we found a photograph of Allison DeFeo, one of the children who was killed that night, one of the DeFeo kids, in her schoolgirl uniform.
And it's very similar. Yeah, it is very similar.
Very spooky.
Yeah, but again, like you said, it seems as if there is anything interesting, if there's anything paranormal going on with the plank, seems to be very residual. It doesn't really seem to have anything to do with anything other than the initial murders that happened in the home.
That's what's a little bit strange about like this case in general, right? In my mind, where it's like all the stuff that the Lutzes were reporting is not typical ghost stuff.
No.
It's not even necessarily typical poltergeist stuff. Some of it is.
I think the marching band noise is the closest.
That kind of stuff. But like this stuff is really off the wall. Like what is going on? I mean, the apparitions, at one point a lion statue like comes to life and like she sees it move and starts, it's like, and then all of the stuff is not about the family that was murdered necessarily.
No.
There isn't even really an intention when you're reading the book that they're trying to bring it back to being about the DeFeo family.
Yeah.
Like they're not even really trying to, because they're focused on like the seance or the Red Room and Jody, and there's not, they're not even really going like, we think that it's you know, the DeFeo family's ghosts that are still here. Like they don't really even make a point of ever saying that. There's sometimes I think that they're alluding to it being something that maybe made Ronnie DeFeo do what he did. But there's no real crossover when it comes to the actual murders that happened in the house.
The closest thing, yeah, like you said, the closest thing is them sort of alluding to the idea that whatever was in the house already that terrorized the Lutzes was already there.
Yeah,
and made Ronnie DeFeo kill his family.
Yeah,
the hooded figure.
Jody.
No,
I don't
Jody
think
Jody was just the babysitter, man.
Exactly.
Like the kids. The thing that's always like the part where, like, at least me, like, I always put a stop in where it's like, oh my gosh, like, you can't blame heinous acts on these little things of weirdness. So it's always like, but in a weird way, the Amityville Horror, like, book, like I was saying, isn't even about the murders.
No.
Which is, in a sense, a little bit more respectful, I guess. But also, like, the whole thing with it leads me to a question, I think, for both of you, where let's say, like, let's scale it back. Let's say that the Lutz family just left. They contacted some people to try to kind of, like, tell their story.
Right.
And one of the people that was contacted was, like, the Channel 5 news agency.
Mm-hmm. Right.
and the news agency brought Ed and Lorraine Warren and the psychics out, and that's when the whole seance happened, and it went really crazy. Let's say that that didn't happen, that the narrative hadn't even gone that far, that Jay Anson hadn't even written his book. What would you do if it was January 1976 and George Lutz like called you on the phone and told you what was happening in his house? How would you two handle the case?
I know what I would do.
I mean, honestly, like, if it is just me and I go to...
Well, I think it'd be both of us.
Yeah.
Like, let's just assume.
Yeah.
Well, I thought you were talking about, like, you're just going to go by yourself.
I'm just going to go investigate this case all by myself.
I want to be there too, Dana.
Okay, fine.
I can contribute.
Okay. No, what I mean is, like, if it's me today going into this investigation and with all the my own back catalog of information, and I see that they have occult books all up and down the walls, yeah, my question is going to be, what are you doing? Let's attack this from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Instead of coming at it as like a, well, we don't really know why this is haunted. Like, I would be like, what did you do, or what are you intending to do? And let's reapproach this, because I think the problem is it was a group of people like that had a horrible experience for 28 days.
Allegedly.
And then left. Right. And then the investigations kind of started. And there was a lot of different opinions and ways of going about things and like intentions, right? Like every person coming to this case after the fact had their own motivation. And I think their own motivation was like a book deal or media attention or whatever it was, right? And I'm not necessarily saying there's anything wrong with that, but I think the problem is they were only getting a very neutered version of events. You know what I mean? Like if George was actually doing things in the house, they very likely didn't know about that. So I would walk into the house and probably maybe recognize some of the things and know what questions to ask in order to create a comfortable space.
Well, because that's the problem. There's people accusing.
Yeah.
There's people who were accusing, you know, they were accused. There was all kinds of ideas about what was actually happening in this house. Like Hans Holzer, who wasn't really part of the investigation,
wrote a couple books about it.
And he was like, he's like, there's an angry Native American chief that's buried under your house, which like is not true. People have since been able to say that's not true, but that's where that terrible trope actually comes from, was Hans Holzer. Because as much as I love Hans Holzer, I have tons of his books. I have an affinity for him. His books suck, and he was kind of a hack.
Mm-hmm.
He just like he did the same thing. The guy in the documentary we watched straight up said, an actual parapsychologist was like, he never met a house that wasn't haunted.
Yes, I would investigate the case as an occultist.
That's what I was getting at. There's all these different opinions about what was going on in that house, and one of them was, well, George was into the occult. Why didn't you call a fucking occultist?
Yeah, like why didn't you?
Why didn't you call? Why didn't you call a witch in to look at this and help you out?
Yeah.
So if that's what you would have done, what I would have done is I would have done what nobody else did, and I would have talked to the kids.
Yes, that's a very good point.
I would have talked to the kids as if they were adults, because kids are so much smarter than everyone gives them credit for.
They're seeing.
You don't
have
to condescend to them.
No.
They see so much more and they talk more.
Yeah.
They would tell you what's actually going on, what they've actually seen.
Uh-huh.
And you can paint a better picture about what's happening there. Maybe what was happening was there was a poltergeist case happening because of the kids.
Yeah.
Typically poltergeist cases happen around younger kids who are going through puberty and they're having extreme anxiety for some reason. Mm-hmm. You find these types of things in hauntings. You find really crazy experiences around hauntings that are taking place in houses where there's lots of like familial trouble, where there's family trauma, there's unresolved issues. We've gotten kind of two sides of the story here. Danny talking about how he thought George was abusive.
Mm-hmm.
But there's Jason who said that George was a great dad.
Yeah. Maybe later in life he was. Maybe he became a better kind of paternal figure.
But I would strip the histrionics. Absolutely not invite fucking frauds like the Warrens.
Mm-hmm.
I would talk to the children. And you know what else I would do? I would say, hey, guess, you know what? You know what, George? We're going to pay the mortgage for the next month.
Yeah.
And we're going to post up and we're going to live in this house together.
Yeah, like spend.
I want to follow you around. Mm-hmm. I want to see what you're up to every day. I want to experience it. Let me and you mm-hmm. live here, mm-hmm. even if they don't want to be there.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that not what went down during the Enfield Poltergeist case? They
yeah.
had a parapsychologist actually just living in the home with them and had experiences.
Yeah. That's how we would do it.
Yeah.
And I imagine we would have come to a much different conclusion, but you probably wouldn't have a really sensational book and film series.
Who knows? Maybe you would. Maybe you'd have a really fascinating, interesting
look
into occult practices and things happening. Like,
you know what it is?
A different kind of book.
It's the Hellier problem. It's there's certain people that expect a certain level of exaggeration
sure.
and extreme violent paranormal activity to be entertained.
Yes.
But you don't get answers that way.
Sure. Yeah.
There's, you know, Hellier's very meditative. It's slow. You know, our new Crone documentary, it's very meditative, but we experience crazy stuff mm-hmm. and we start to find answers when we're not scared of the thing we're investigating.
Yeah.
So if we had the opportunity to do it, I would try and talk to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be the perfect person to have to investigate any potential spiritualism or occult or witchcraft related stuff that maybe George and Kathy were into.
Yeah.
And present
non-judgmentally.
It. Present it in a non-judgmental way
yeah.
that makes sense to people, the same way that we do on television now.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the 70s, you know, I mean, people were starting to become open to a lot of those ideas and techniques and, you know, transcendental meditation and yoga and stuff like that. But you'd still be hard pressed to find someone probably at that time period that didn't hear the word occult and just think like,
yeah, of
you
course.
Know,
I mean, even today, that's a problem.
Yeah.
You know, the 90s was bad for that. But we see it coming around today with all like the QAnon horse shit. There's
yeah.
still anyone who's into the occult is, you know, eating babies and, you know, summoning the devil.
Jody,
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 Jody.
We are Team Jody here at the Haunted Objects Podcast.
Connor Jode.
I think at the end of the day, we'll never know what actually happened at Amityville.
Yeah.
We only can see different people's tunnel vision about what they wanted it to be.
Yes.
Whether it's Hans Holzer wanting to blame it all on the Native Americans, as he did.
Boo.
Boo. Whether it was the Warrens wanting to blame it on the devil, as they always did.
Boo.
Boo. Or it was a combination of really strange residual stuff in a house where a terrible tragedy had happened mm-hmm. and the media had given it tons of attention. We know when you give something a lot of attention, you seem to make things manifest.
Yes.
And then George, I think we can say from someone who knew him, it seems pretty obvious that George was into the occult.
Mm-hmm.
He was into weird stuff.
And obviously, as Jason said, felt as if it was something he couldn't talk to everyone about.
Right.
Kept it very kind of private.
With all of these stories that are attached to this famous place, I'm glad that we can have a piece of it
mm-hmm.
to maintain. Because here's the thing, nobody can go there anymore.
Yeah.
All the owners who've lived there, by the way, have not experienced any other weird stuff. The scariest thing they have to deal with are people outside of their house at all hours
That's
of the night.
That's kind of crazy. That brings into my mind just a slight question of like haunted people versus haunted places, like you were saying.
Right.
Because it's like even if like thought form spirits manifest and mm-hmm. a whole bunch of people think about haunted place, they should all be sending them to that place if that theory is working in mm-hmm. that context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that doesn't seem to be the case because maybe the ghost was around George the whole time
mm-hmm.
as an idea.
I think that's probably the case. I think we should have a seance using this object as a trigger piece and let's try and summon Jody.
My boy.
Let's summon Jody. We do live experiments in the museum all the time. I think this will be a fun one.
That will be very fun.
We're going to plan a live seance with the Amityville plank.
I love this idea.
to try and summon Jody, the ghostly pigman babysitter.
The ghostly pigman babysitter.
We will do that live sometime around this episode.
Yeah, we'll plan it.
If you want to be part of that, join the museum.
Come become a museum member.
We do experiments like that all the time.
Talk to pigs with us.
Visit patreon.com/paramuseum. Join the museum. We'll do a live seance. Let's talk to Jody. Mm-hmm. Let's find out the truth about who Jody really is. Let's ask Jody himself.
Yes.
What was the deal?
What was the deal?
Well, there's so many stories that are attached to this plank. We have our own stories that we've experienced. Jason, we talked to him about his stories that he's experienced. And, you know, this was a piece of one of the most iconic haunted house stories in history.
Yeah.
Not only that, but it was there and saw a terrible tragedy, a terrible crime mm-hmm. that people are still talking about today. Mm-hmm. We'll never know the answer. But that is why the Amityville Plank is a haunted object.
The Haunted Objects podcast is hosted by Greg and Dana Newkirk, produced by Connor J. Randall, with photography directed by Carl Pfeiffer, and features exclusive artifacts from the Newkirk Museum of the Paranormal. To learn more about the artifacts featured in this episode, take part in live interactive experiments, and enjoy exclusive Haunted Objects content, become a museum member at patreon.com/paramuseum. This has been a Planet Weird production.
I'm getting ready. I'm getting into it.
Okay.
I hated that.
I'm calling in the spirits.
That's not how. What?